Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am chatting today with Carl Lane. He is a professor of history at Felician College in New Jersey. He holds his PhD in history from the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and he is the author of A Nation Wholly Free, The Elimination of the National Debt in the Age of Jackson. And, you know, you had mentioned, Carl, in the last segment that from 1825 to really 1835, that 10-year time frame, that Congress committed themselves to the elimination of debt. That Congress certainly sounds a lot different than the Congress a lot of people are familiar with today. can you comment on just the makeup of Congress at that time?
Well, in the period after the War of 1812, the Federalist Party disappeared as an institution in American political life. And so there was only one party, the Jeffersonian Republican Party. And they just simply agreed that debt had to be eliminated, and eliminated as promptly as was possible. And so in 1817, they enacted the Redemption Act, which provided a formula for the elimination of the national debt over the next, 20 years or whatever that turned out to be. And so there was consensus among the members of Congress. In fact, they didn't even have a roll call vote on the Redemption Act. They just passed it without that kind of parliamentary formality. And basically, Adams, as I said, he seemed to be out of step with Congress on the debt matter. And when Jackson became president, everybody knew his view on the national debt, and he remained committed to eliminating it, and he did.
So would you?
There's one other little point here, if I may.
Please.
One of the things that struck me during the research on this project was how very, very similar, the political opposition emerged to challenge Adams, how bitter the partisanship quickly became, and the kinds of exaggerations and distortions of the truth that characterize a lot of what goes on in our Congress today characterized the Congress back then. And I was recently telling somebody that, you know, you could take some of the speeches from the 1830s and put them into the mouths of people in Congress today. It is just remarkable. And the fact that it seems like nothing has really changed over all of these years.
Well, we have a philosophy that faced with the same sets of facts and circumstances, historically speaking, collective groups of politicians tend to behave similarly. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
You know, let me jump in, because is to what extent would you say that Andrew Jackson, as the president, deserves credit for getting the nation to a point that it was debt-free? He gets a lot of credit historically, but how much of it should he really get?
I think that he deserves the credit that he's gotten, because even though Congress passed the Redemption Act in 1817, it required an executive who was going to remain committed to a program that led to the elimination of the debt in 1835. In fact, he was during his first term in office, he was hoping to eliminate the debt in 1833. Well, things happened, like the nullification crisis in South Carolina, that got in the way of that, but come 1835, the debt was in fact eliminated. And his commitment to eliminating, and why he deserves credit, has to do with his his vetoes of internal improvement projects, the refusal to recharter the Bank of the United States, and other matters that he could have taken a different position on, but which, if he had, might very well have thrown the Monroe schedule for debt freedom out of whack. So I think that he deserves the credit that he is accorded, because he provided leadership in a way that most Americans at the time apparently respected.
So our guest today, if you're just joining us, is Carl Lane. His book is A Nation Wholly Free, The Elimination of the National Debt in the Age of Jackson. I would encourage you to check it out. To what extent, Jackson didn't like the central bank very much either. In fact, he was responsible for, really spearheading an effort that had the second central bank of the United States, today's Federal Reserve. So can you comment on that? I've read some historical accounts that, you read about Nicholas Biddle, the chair of the Federal Reserve. You can almost insert Janet Yellen's name into that.
Yeah, the bank matter was a problem for Jackson. First of all, he distrusted banks to begin with. He had, as a young man, an unfortunate experience with debt to a bank, and the distrust that he had of banks in general really focused on the Second Bank of the United States. And the bank had been created in 1816 for 20 years, and the charter was to expire in 1836. Well, the question came up early in Jackson's term about whether or not the bank should be rechartered. And Jackson gave many a warning in his annual messages that he was not pleased with the present operations of the bank. One of the principal functions of the bank was to make the payments on principal and interest on the national debt. And so as the debt got pared down and heading to zero, Jackson saw a little point in supporting a recharter, since one of the bank's major obligations would have been discharged. He also felt that the effort by Nicholas Biddle and Henry Clay and John Quincy Adams and others to get an early bill to recharter the bank passed in 1832, represented an effort on the bank's part and his opposition's part to confront him with the danger of losing the 1832 election if he was going to put the nation's economy in danger by vetoing the bill. Well, Andrew Jackson was not one to be intimidated. And as he told Martin Van Buren, the bank is trying to kill me, but I will kill it. And he did. And when he vetoed the bank bill, he did not know how Americans were going to receive the veto message. And here's another dimension of Jackson's leadership. You know, there were no public opinion polls back in those days. And so he didn't know when he vetoed the bill if he would be making more enemies than friends. But committed as he was to a vision of a debt-free nation, which would provide assurance to American liberties, he went ahead and vetoed the bill. And the bank, of course, never recovered.
So, Carl, can you talk a bit from the the dismantling, if you will, of the Second Central Bank of the United States through the Panic of 1837. Can you talk a bit, in the 3 minutes or so we have left, to what extent monetary policy led to the Panic of 1837?
Well, the bank, of course, its charter ended in 1836, and the bank reorganized as the Bank of Pennsylvania, as opposed to a national bank. And it, like other state banks around the country, wound up receiving distribution funds under the Distribution Bill of 1836. And as I mentioned a little bit earlier, that revenue going into state banks wound up being loaned out by state banks to land companies, which were looking to invest in the public lands. Under the law at the time, the federal lands in the western states could be purchased at $1.25 per acre. Well, everybody knew that there was western expansion, and so land companies bought up the public lands at the minimum price in order to sell to incoming settlers at a profit. But once they did that, the money was returned to the different banks and then loaned out again. And according to Jackson, this was inherently inflationary. The bubble in the price of the public lands was burst by Jackson himself in late 1836 with the so-called specie circular. The specie circular simply required that any public land being purchased had to be purchased in gold and silver coin and not in paper money. And the consequence of that was to, as I said, burst the bubble in the price of the public lands. But it also raised the question among the business community that if the President of the United States could, on his own authority, demonetize banknotes for a particular asset, then could not the President do that with regard to other matters, such as, for example, the tariff? What if tariff payments had to be made in gold and silver coin also? In the end, it turned out that the banks, starting in New York, began to fail because gold and silver assets or reserves wound up heading west to deal with the specie circular, and the law that required them to exchange their notes to gold and silver coin on demand could no longer be met. And so major banking institutions went into bankruptcy. The domino effect throughout the economy was that people lost their jobs, tariff revenues declined sharply, and as a consequence, the government of the United States didn't have enough money to operate. And so, bingo, we were back into borrowing.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. It's been a fascinating conversation. Our guest today has been Carl Lane. The book is A Nation Wholly Free, The Elimination of the National Debt in the Age of Jackson. And, Carl, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much.
And thanks again to our special guest on both podcasts this week, Mr. Carl Lane, author of A Nation Wholly Free. You know, at this time of year, you always hear pundits and analysts making a 2015 forecast about where the economy's going and maybe what the stock market's going to look like. And I have a question for you. Whenever you hear a pundit or an analyst make a prediction as to where the market's going, did it ever occur to you that there is at least a reasonable chance that that forecast will be wrong? Let me give you some examples, because in preparation for today's program, I went out and looked at some of the market forecasts that were being made for 2015. Bank of America, Merrill Lynch issued their global research forecast back on December the 9th. And in that forecast, you'll find these words. The Standard & Poor's 500 index is expected to rise to 2200 during 2015. While we believe the era of excess returns and excessively low volatility is in the past, the secular bull market in stocks should continue. Expected gains in the year ahead imply a price return of approximately 6%. Vanguard also issued their report and forecast, and here's what they say about the global equity market for 2015. After several years of suggesting that strong equity returns were possible despite a prolonged period of subpar economic growth, our outlook for global equities has become more guarded. The expected 10-year median nominal return is below historical averages and has shifted toward the bottom of the 6 to 9% range compared with this time last year. That's a reflection of less constructive market valuations in the United States and some other developed markets. Kiplinger's published an article titled Stock Market Outlook for 2015. The article was written by Ann Cates Smith. This article said, bull markets don't always age gracefully. This one may be entering its golden years, beset by uncertainties and buffeted by cross currents. Toward the end of 2014, a long period of calm gave way to increasing volatility, and you can expect more of the same in 2015 as the sedative of an ultra-easy monetary policy starts to wear off. Later in the article, but for now, the bullish case is not only intact, it's strong. A vibrant stateside economy will provide strong support for U.S. stocks, while Europe's woes will create some compelling bargains. Analysts expect earnings growth in 2015 of 8 to 10% on average for companies in the S&P 500. So three forecasts that are bullish or somewhat bullish for the stock market. Then there was an article published on Bloomberg back on November 11. Here are some words from that article. In 1929, a businessman and economist by the name of Jerome Levy didn't like what he saw in his analysis of corporate profits. He sold his stocks before the October crash that year. Almost eight decades later, the consultancy company that bears his name declared, the next recession will be caused by the deflating housing bubble. By February of 2007, it predicted problems in the subprime mortgage market would spread to virtually all financial markets. In 2007, it saw imminent recession. The slump began 2 months later. The Jerome Levy Forecasting Center, based in Mount Kisco, New York, and run by Jerome's grandson, David, is once again more worried than its peers. Its half-dozen analysts attach a 65% probability of a worldwide recession forcing a contraction in the U.S. by the end of next year. That call runs counter to the forecasts of Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs Group, Inc. The two banks pose it an expansion that has plenty of room to run. An article in Money News talked about the fact, this was written on December 25 by Christian Hill, and the article talks about the fact that there's overwhelming evidence the next stock market crash could strike any day now, and a growing number of investors are turning to a noted economist to prepare for the unthinkable. The message is clear. Despite the Dow hitting pre-crash highs, companies reporting positive earnings, and the financial media saying we're looking at the beginning of a new bull market, the stock market, at least according to this article, is on the verge of another historic collapse. The article talks about and shows five charts, and obviously on the radio I can't show you the charts, but let me give you the five reasons that this particular author thinks the market will correct. The S&P 500 consensus earnings per share is expected to come in much lower than originally thought. Estimates started out near $125 in January 2012, have now fallen 10% to only $112. Despite the warning sign of falling earnings, the S&P continues to climb. Reason number two, stocks are currently very expensive compared to their 10-year average. While stocks typically have a price-to-earnings ratio of 15, they now sit at a ratio closer to 23. That means stocks are priced currently 53% higher than their 10-year average, which should worry any investor. Reason number three, investors are extremely bullish on the market right now. The bullish extreme measurement is nearing a 10-year high, and most of us know from experience what happens when market sentiment is too far one way or another. A snapback occurs. If the herd is currently this bullish, it's generally a good idea to be very cautious. The fourth reason, the volatility index is near an historic low. As markets have rebounded over the last few years, investors have become complacent. They have priced nearly all risk out of the market, and it will take only one scary event to send volatility higher and investors fleeing the market. And finally, reason number five, the last two times the market climbed this high, a severe correction took place. The first two advances were over 100% and then were followed by a crash of roughly 50%. That was the run-up from the mid-90s to the correction that began in 2000, and that was the run-up from the market bottom in 2002 to the market correction that began in 2007. Well, this latest rally from the market bottom in March of 2009 has now exceeded 100%. So, is it likely the market is setting itself up for another drastic correction? So here's the big question. Who should you believe? They can't all be right. The market can't go up by 6% and crash in the same year. So who should you believe and what strategies might you consider implementing? We give you some resources to consider using and implementing in your situation in our free Investors Discovery Kit. The Investors Discovery Kit is free. All you have to do to get it is visit the website, investingapproach.com. The website, again, is investingapproach.com. And if you let us know your name and where you'd like us to mail the Investor's Discovery Kit, we will get you this packet of educational materials. It contains the book, New Retirement Rules, a copy of the New Economy magazine, as well as an educational CD and DVD. Again, to visit the website and get your free Investor's Discovery Kit, just go to investingapproach.com. That's our second podcast for the week. Hope you enjoyed it and got some information you can use. Thanks for listening.